Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
We have with us today a very distinguished guest, Dr. Barry Rose, OBE. Welcome to Crossover, Barry.
Thank you very much for having me.
All of that very, very impressive introduction explained to our audience, please. You are the Order of the British Empire?
Yes, it's a member of the Order of the British Empire. It's a decoration given to you by the Queen.
And next step is knighthood, isn't it?
Well, I think so, but I'm too old for that now.
One never knows. And, of course, you have your doctorate in music. And tell us, you are considered by many to be probably the best, you say, choir trainer.
That's what we call it in England, yes.
Yes, which is really a choir master and someone who really, I guess, educates the choir, brings the choir up to a certain level of excellence.
Yes, you just don't teach them notes. You teach them the understanding of what they're singing. I particularly have worked with children all my life, boys and girls, mostly boys, but also adults. And you just work with them to say, look, there's a lot beyond the notes. The words got there first before the notes. So yes, you've got to explain to them. You know, they've got to sing with understanding. And that's a tough nut to crack.
Well, very difficult. And also, I don't think people realize the role of the organist and choir director, is how demanding it is. But you are really on a very, very high level. And what I wanted to ask you was, first to begin with, your choirs, are these choirs that people audition to be in?
Yes. In English cathedrals, it's very different setup from parish churches. Some places have what they call choir schools or cathedral schools, and you do audition to come in and be a member of the treble line. That's the top line of the choir. A boy, of course, is a treble, and yes, a lady is a soprano.
Yes. But, of course, now you have, well, we have to start at the beginning, which is very surprising because you weren't even interested in doing that at some point where you were making a career of it. You had done something else. I mean, you played the harmonium, I guess, as a young boy, right?
Yes, I'm the son of a truck driver who lived in the East End of London. My mother and father were both amateur musicians. And as a young man, they, like most children, they sent me to have piano lessons at the with a local lady. But they also sent me to the local Sunday school, and it was there I got fascinated by hymns, you know, playing, particularly as I fell in love with a girl playing hymns on the piano.
Well, that will do it, definitely, always. The impetus is there.
And then somebody said, well, there's a vacancy at a little local mission church for someone to play the harmonium. Now, it so happened that my father had brought home a harmonium on the back of his truck and put it in our front room. And there I'd sit peddling away, you know, sort of with a hymn book open.
Now, the harmonium is like a little organ, isn't it?
That's right.
Are there pedals on it?
That's right. You have to create the air in it by your feet.
The bellows.
That's right, yes. And you get sort of swell effects by using your knee and things.
I see. So it was a little thing, and you had lots of fun with it.
Yes, I taught myself, really, to play hymns. And then somebody said, well, why don't you come and play at this little local church? So I did that for 10 years.
Now, how old were you when you came to
church? I was 11 when I did
that. So you started doing that.
Yes. I mean, I'd learnt the piano a little before that, but I was rather dilatory about learning the piano. I mean, I never practiced properly. It wasn't me. And I knew that I wanted to play hymns somewhere.
Did you sing at all?
No, not as a boy. And that's an interesting thing because I've taught so many boys to sing. And it was later in life that I realised, a friend took me aside and said, look, you've got to understand how a singer works. I'm in the best church choir in London. In fact, the best church choir in England, which was Hampstead Parish Church. This is in the 1950s. And he said, come and do an audition. And I said, well, I don't sing. He said, well, come round to my house. And he said, well, one thing you can do is you can sight read. You can read the notes. And he said, I bet you get into the choir and you can take your voice on from there. And that's where it all happened for me. Those
so
two
what
years.
Was your, what were you, a tenor or a bass?
No, I was a baritone.
A baritone.
So that was my choir voice.
That's a very bad pun,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, well, I was an undistinguished baritone and I got in the choir because I could sight read. I was petrified at the audition. I remember tearing the music in half because I was shaking so much and handing him back two bits.
Uh-huh.
But he let me in the choir, and I learnt it all by sitting in the back of this choir and being part of a team that was really, really good.
I admire the choir directors who have non-professionals, I mean, in their choir, but really non-professionals, who a lot of them don't sight read as well.
That is true, but we're at the top end of things, and we were in a hurry to broadcast things like the Stravinsky Mass, you know, or Britain's Rejoice in the Lamb.
Oh, my.
I mean, we were given these things, and we broadcast it live. And, of course, in those days when you recorded, you didn't take one measure at a time.
You
took the whole thing,
course,
and
right.
That was it.
Now, you were, again, how old at this time?
I had left school, and my parents, you know how parents are, said, you better get a proper job. Now, I wasn't much of an academic at school, and I wasn't terribly good at music. In fact, my children recently dug out my last school report, much of my embarrassment, and it says, music, grade C.
Oh, it's average.
Too easily self-satisfied.
Oh, I love it.
So they wave that at me occasionally, you see, and say, well, look what you did, Dad, you see.
Yes.
And I'd left school without any real qualifications. I wasn't good enough to go to university. But a friend of mine took me under his wing, and he happened to be a student at the Royal College of Music, and he smuggled me into lectures by Herbert Howells and things like that, and took me on a life-changing experience. He took me to the chapel of King's College, Cambridge, where the choir was run by a man called Boris Ord, and it was really a fantastic experience. I can still hear it now in my mind, and I must have been 13, 14 then. But music was not to be for me, apart from being a hobby. And my father said, well, go off and get a proper job in a bank or an insurance office.
Which you did.
Which I did. And for 8 years, I worked in an insurance office.
But you must have been doing something with music.
Oh, yes, I was. Yes, I mean, I joined the Hampstead Parish Church Choir in that time. And then I went on to run my own little choir at a suburban London church. And it was while I was there and still working in the insurance office, I said, well, what? One day I came back late from giving a lunchtime organ recital in the City of London, and my boss said, you ought to make up your mind whether you want to do music or insurance.
Yeah. You and Charles Ives, I think.
That's right. So I said, well, in a fit of, youthful pique sort of thing, I said, oh, come on, I'll go and do music. Now, I had no idea what I was saying.
And you were still quite young.
Yes, I was 23 then. Mm-hmm. So I went off and auditioned for the Royal Academy of Music, see if I could get in as what they call a mature student. And I did manage to get in because the principal there had been a cathedral organist himself. And I think he could see some sort of potential in this young, you know, person who had no real pianistic technique or anything. I mean, he could play the organ perfectly well. And I spent 2 years there.
At the Royal College of Music?
Royal Academy of Music.
Royal Academy of Music.
Yeah, there are the two in London. There's a Royal College of Music and the Royal Academy of Music. And I chose the Academy because they had an organ teacher called C.H. Trevor, who was known to be the best organ teacher, one of the best organ teachers in the country. And people who heard me play tapped me on the shoulder and said, you ought to go and get some
really
proper organ lessons.
Yes, right. So you were basically learning the organ and learning vocal music at a certain level. You had enough guts, I guess, to kind of go out there and perform, even though you didn't have all of the sheepskin or the credentials that were supposedly accepted in the music world, I guess.
Well, in those days, and it still is true, to get a cathedral appointment in England, you were supposed to have gone through what they call the Oxbridge system, which is Oxford and Cambridge. And been an organ scholar at one of these rather famous places like St. John's College or King's College or Christ Church Oxford or New College Oxford or wherever. But I had come out of the insurance office.
But you really had a determination, and you probably had a lot of, you felt that you were qualified or that you could give back something. I mean, you just don't
A voice inside you says, look, you know, you've got to go and do this. And that's going to require determination of a particular sort. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe your career is mapped out for you. Who knows? We don't know what how our lives are planned. And I've always believed that there's a hand that says, go there. Go there, do that. I mean, I had no idea this new cathedral in England was being built and finished. This was in Guildford. Now, Guildford is in the county of Surrey, and it's about 25 miles south of London. And like many people, I'd been there as a sightseer and bought a brick. You could buy a brick for a certain amount of money.
Yes, and sign have it, to, and sign, inscribed,
and have it into the wall. The Queen had bought one.
Yes,
and there
of
was,
course.
Her signature was on show. Everyone else's wasn't on show, of course.
The money was still the same.
That's right. You see, she probably didn't pay for it.
Like that's right.
But I went down there and I thought, one day some lucky person is going to be organist and choirmaster of this brand new cathedral, never dreaming it would be me. And I was at the Royal Academy, and I was an impecunious student. I couldn't afford the bus fare to get there, even. I was walking, you know, distances to get to the Academy. And one day, an advertisement appeared in a thing called the Daily Telegraph, one of our big broadsheets.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it said, organist required for New Guildford Cathedral. Now, I never read the Daily Telegraph, never. But that one particular day, I just happened to see it.
Mm-hmm.
That one day. And if that's not providence, I want to know
what
absolutely.
Is. Oh, absolutely. I believe in it.
And so I slammed in an application. I thought, this is for me. You see, having just failed all the organ exams, I'll have a go at this.
Again.
And I thought, I'll hear no more. And the phone rang. And they said, could you come to the Royal College of Music, which is the other place in London,
yes.
next Tuesday, for an audition? So I said, yes, I'll come. And so I went to this audition at the Royal College of Music. And it was not a happy experience.
What did you play?
I played a set of variations by a Belgian composer called Floor Peters. And I had worked on these. It's round a Christmas carol called King Jesus Hath a Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And that went all right. That was fine. And you also had to improvise. They put a theme up on the organ.
Oh,
and
yes.
Now, that's not my strong point.
That's very difficult.
I mean, some people do it very well. I can make it sound reasonable, but it wasn't terribly good, to be honest. And then we had an interview, which was a complete disaster. So,
in what sense?
Well, they brought in two music advisors, very distinguished, older cathedral organists, and they kept asking me theoretical questions, holding up a piece of Palestrina or something, and saying, how would you perform this piece of Palestrina? And in the end, I got rather cross. I was rather young, and I thought I'd got nothing to lose. And I said, look, why don't you ask me how you're going to have found a choir and find an organ for a cathedral that's due to be consecrated. It's already fixed to be consecrated with the Queen and everybody else coming in May next year. Why don't you ask me how we're going to found a choir for this? This is surely the important number one priority.
Get
this
it going, thing. Of course.
You know, and in the end, I said, look, we're wasting each other's time, really. So I
flounced out of there.
Well, I didn't flounce, but I left. And as I went down the steps of the Royal College of Music, the provost who ran the cathedral at Guildford came down, tapped me on the shoulder, said, come and see me tomorrow morning.
Were there many people that applied for this position?
Yes, I'm told 140 applied for it.
My.
So
your person, I guess you're...
Very fortunate and very, maybe it was meant to be, but it was a daunting prospect. He took me up to the cathedral, and in my youthful enthusiasm, you know, I said, well, yes, I can do this. You know how...
And how much time did you have? 9 months?
9 months to found a choir from nothing and get an organ installed and have it all ready for this great service. But not just for that day, but for the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. Because cathedrals in England sing every day of the week, but one. So you could have evensong on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and three services on Sunday.
And the Queen was coming when?
May the 17th, 1961, for the consecration of the cathedral. This is the first cathedral in England to be consecrated on a new site since the Middle Ages.
And it was 1960, what did you say, 61?
61. I went there in September 1960 with a blank canvas, if you like, this huge building, and all on my shoulders to found the thing.
How did you do it?
I went to a local school. In England, we call them preparatory schools. They are for boys aged 5 to 13 years old. And I talked to the headmaster, who was a little suspicious of this chap who'd come from nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But then I met the music master, who said, strangely enough, said, oh, I was once a chorister of St. Paul's Cathedral. I'd love to help you.
Providence all the way down.
Yes. And so he let me, the headmaster let me found the choir within this school. And gradually, he said, you can do it, providing you can accept boys who are already in this school and train them. So I did it, and from then on, it's a bit of history.
It really is history, and it's rather remarkable because you got everything together for the Queen's consecration visit or whatever.
Yes, I mean, the big day is reasonably easy because it's a very high profile. We were televised, it was on the radio, you know, we had... you know, it was a high-profile day for the whole of England. It was the front cover of our Radio Times, you know, and that sort of thing.
Well,
you know.
Now, what kind of program did you prepare?
I didn't go too ambitious. I wrote some psalm chants myself. We had trumpeters sort of playing national anthem and fanfares mm-hmm. and things. We sang a piece by William Byrd, a short piece, when they dedicated the altar. And we sang an anthem called Sing Joyfully. I remember it very well. And nothing too ambitious. You know, it just worked very well. And the day after, I had a letter from the composer, Herbert Howells, who very kindly wrote to me and said he watched it and he was very thrilled at the way it was had been sung and wished me all happiness.
Now, again, of course, it sounds impossible, really, but it, of course, happened. And when you got these boys from the school, were they already singing in chorus, or
they were in a school choir, so we knew that they had some sort of ear for singing, but they didn't know any of the repertoire, and they didn't have the power to produce for a building that is 300 feet long mm-hmm. or something. So we had to work at this, you know, the technique of singing.
When you transmit your idea to people who don't really understand what you're doing, I mean, I say not even reading music, but how to breathe and how to phrase a line. How do you transmit that?
You start with happy birthday or something they know, and you take it on from there. I've recently been taking a choir here in Philadelphia, and the boys were slightly shocked when I said, now I'm going to do for you what I've done for every singing pupil I've ever had. This is from the age of 7 to the age of 37, or however, mm-hmm. you know, whatever age I've taught. I'm going to make you sing the first two lines of Bar, Bar, Black Sheep. And they looked rather askance at me. And I said, why? And they didn't quite understand. I said, because in there is a question, have you any wool? And then comes the answer, yes, sir, yes, sir. And that way you teach people to use their diaphragms, which is the singer's greatest ally, because that's where the power of your voice comes from. It comes from deep inside you. And by the time we got to the end of the rehearsal, they were making twice as much noise as when they started.
So you had more sound coming
out. That's right.
But of course,
and without harming their vocal cords.
Yes.
And they've got to have a technique of some sort. Everyone has to have a technique of some sort.
But, of course, when you're talking about boys at a certain age, the voice changes.
Yes, it does, and it changes much earlier these days, even from when I started.
Why do you think that is?
It's all the additives and things in all the foods
the
that
hormones,
we have.
Yes, I guess,
the hormones
right.
kicking mm-hmm. much quicker. So, I mean, in the old days, I mean, there is an apocryphal story in London about a cathedral chorister who went up to his choir master on Friday night and said, please, sir, may I be excused from evensong tomorrow? And the choir master said, why? And the boy said, because I'm getting married. When that's true or not. But they were recording at the age of 15 and 16.
Really?
It was a very famous record in England called Hear My Prayer by Ernest Lough. And it sold millions and millions of copies. He was a chorister at the Temple Church in London. And he was 16 when he last recorded it. It's a treble.
So that's really something. I mean, it's incredible. Well, it's better than the castrati. That's the way they used to do it in the old days,
yes,
right,
yes,
I guess.
Yes.
So now you have Guildford Cathedral Choir. This is the very first that you developed, and this is one of your pride and joys?
Yes, it really is my pride and joy, because it was, as I said, it was a blank canvas, and it was a choir that started from nothing and gradually got better and better and better and better. So much so that men from these famous choirs, like King's College, Cambridge, and places like that, would ask to come and sing at Guildford because they could hear the boys singing. And would you believe it? One day somebody from EMI Records came to Evensong and offered us an exclusive recording contract.
How amazing. Amazing. But doesn't the choir keep changing? That's the other thing.
Yes, it does. Yeah, you have to always be training what we call prep boys or novice boys.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what the most important rehearsal of the week, so that they are ready to step into the shoes of those who go on. And as far as the men are concerned, yes, it does change. So you have to... You try and keep them for as long as you can, particularly the ones who are really part of a team.
The whole concept of that, of you're preparing them to go out into the world, in a sense, and then they leave you.
Yes.
And then you start all over again.
Yes, you do. But, I mean, that's the life that you take on when you have boys in a choir. There are many girls' cathedral choirs in England now, but they still leave at the age of 14 or 15, perhaps a bit older than the boys.
And, of course, jumping the gun a little, I mean, you have ex students, I guess, who have really achieved tremendous success as I guess, choral singers. I mean,
I think that the 16, which is one of our very famous groups, but it's probably staffed by ex-choristers from St. Paul's Cathedral.
Really?
The Hilliard Ensemble,
yes,
the tenor.
Another brilliant.
The tenor is one of my choristers. The King Singers, the present tenor, mm-hmm. is one of my choristers. The pop group, yes, has a bass guitar who is a chorister of mine. Simply Red, the keyboard player, is one of ex-choristers.
How does this make you feel? And one says, well, you train choristers, and that they don't even have a name for that. I mean, it's very odd.
You train them for life. You don't train them necessarily to go and do music. Those who are successful, many of them are successful, barristers, lawyers, surgeons, teachers, they all have these values, this self-discipline that only a child of that age can have, because they're professionals at the age of 7 and 8. I mean, they're matching professionals who sing behind them.
There's so much to be said for music as a discipline.
It is the ultimate discipline, of course. Yeah. And wasn't it? I think it was St. Augustine or somebody said, "He who sings prays twice." Which is a nice way of summing it up.
It's wonderful. Yes, it's wonderful. Tell us a little bit about this. This is a French carol, but the pronunciation. Tell us a little bit about that.
This is John Rutter's arrangement. John Rutter, of course, is one of our most distinguished musicians,
and
he arranged this French carol called Il est né le divin enfant. And in fact, he recorded it, and I was rehearsing it with the Guildford Choir on the Isle of Jersey. And somebody who spoke French came up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Would you mind if I told you that it's actually le divin enfant?"
And it's not spelled that way.
No, it's not spelled that way. But this is the Guildford Choir at its absolute peak in 1973. This is the result of 13 years' work. And this is the sound that they made. And this is in a live concert. And the reason it's a Christmas carol, I do have to say, is because we track the whole of the church's year in music in one concert for 2.5 hours.
Okay, this is one part of your wonderful career, your brilliant career, I have to say, which you never planned. And you are a fixture at the BBC now at this point, aren't you?
Well, it's a strange thing happened. The BBC do what they call outside broadcasts, and they decided they were going to broadcast the Durofle Requiem from Guildford Cathedral, and they were going to bring to do it the BBC Symphony Orchestra and the BBC Choral Society. Now, I said to the conductor, wouldn't it be nice if some of the little parts of the plain song parts of the Durofle Requiem were sung by the boys up in a gallery? And he said, yes, that'd be terrific. So we put the boys up in the gallery, and they took part in this, and they sang very nicely. And at the end of the concert, he said to me, "Do you know, there's a job going at the BBC. It's a very special job. It's called Religious Music Advisor. It's actually called Music Advisor, the head of religious broadcasting. Only two people have ever held this job," he said. "One was Sir Henry Walford Davis, and the other was Sir George Thalben Ball, both very distinguished church musicians. Would you mind if I put your name forward?" So I said, "Well, fine," and I heard no more. And then the phone rang, and it was the head of religious broadcasting at the BBC, and said, "Would you like to come have lunch with me?" And he offered me the job over lunch.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this sounds like a fairy tale. All of it does.
Well, it is a fairy tale, because that's part of the real establishment in England, you know, to go to the BBC.
Of course, and of course, even the whole idea of being a choir master, I mean, that too has some very rigid rules as well.
Yes, but I think they wanted somebody who was a practical musician there, because they wanted someone who would not only run programs, but also take part in programs at the drop of a hat. You know, you'd be asked to go and compose a signature tune, you know, and go and record it, or go and review a book about music or whatever. So through the microphone, you make your voice known.
So you were the jack of all trades, I guess. Chief cook and bottle washer, I guess we call it.
The BBC has a daily act of worship. It still runs. It's one of the oldest BBC programmes, just celebrated its 80th anniversary. It's called The Daily Service. And that was part of my job, to go up there in the morning and rehearse this with the BBC singers, and then it transmission live.
So it's a live performance every day.
It's a live service every day. And I still do it when I go home from here. I'm going to go up to Manchester for a week, and I meet the singers, and then we do the live transmission. It's all over by 10 o'clock in the morning.
Now, do you play? Of course, you plan ahead, and you have repertoire that you're...
Fit it all in with the liturgical content. So whatever the reading is, or whatever the mood of the service is, if it's Thanksgiving or if it's penitential, you choose music to go around it. But it all has to be done down to the second, as you will know.
Of course. So you're a radio man.
Oh, yes. Yes, as well as I have presented television programs, too.
I think we need about 2 hours to talk to you about that. But in terms of radio and live radio, this is also something that's wonderful, that it's still alive and well.
There's nothing like live radio. There's an adrenaline which comes when the red light goes on.
Right.
Which you don't get in rehearsal. And often producers make the big mistake of asking the singers to deliver in the rehearsal. I never do. I know perfectly well.
Well, you know what happens when the light goes on, they're going to do it.
And the BBC singers never did, and annoyed the producers totally because I can't hit the words. Yeah, I say, you wait till the red light goes on, uh-huh, you will.
Uh-huh. It's amazing. It is a magical thing. It's just like doing a live performance.
That's right.
I mean, it's in rehearsal, it's one way, and then things happen when the light goes on or whatever. So they're still doing that. This is really unique.
In this world of
digital everything and pre-recorded and so on. This is really
and also
quite
in this secular world as well. I mean, this is a Christian act of worship which takes place every morning of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
At what time?
At 9:45 a.m. And it finishes at just as the pips, we have Greenwich time pips in England, they come at 10 o'clock. And it has to be exact.
I know that Greenwich, I was there. Okay, so this still is going on.
Yes, and I was trying to run this from Guildford, Guildford. And funnily enough, again, the phone rang one night, and it was the organist of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, saying, would I be interested in a possible move to London? Having discussed it with my wife, we decided that we would go from Guildford, having done what I set out to do, and perhaps go and live in London, make all this commuting a little bit easier to the BBC.
So, actually, then you went to St. Paul's.
Yes, I went to St. Paul's as sub-organist. Now, this is something I'd never done because I'd always had someone to play the organ for me in Guildford. I can play perfectly well, but I never had to concentrate on playing the organ. There was a hidden agenda behind it at St. Paul's. They got me there because they wanted me to train the boys of the choir, and that later became very clear when they offered me the post of Master of the Choir of St. Paul's.
I see. So did you, sub-organist, is that kind of a
you are assistant,
relief?
No, you're full-time. You are assistant, but you're available to play for the services while somebody stands in front of the choir and directs them. In that case, my colleague, the organist, Christopher Dernley, was doing it.
I see.
But he soon realised it was better the other way round. If he got on the organ and I stood in front of the choir.
Of course. So how long were you at St. Paul's?
Well, we moved there in 1974, and as I went in the door of St. Paul's, I said to my wife, I bet we're going to be here 10 years, and it happened to be 10 years to the day. I had no idea it would end like it was going to end, but it was 10 years, and it was quite long enough to be in the centre of the city of London. We had 2 children when we moved there, and we had a third up in when we were living there. And I think, you know, bringing up a family in the confines of the centre of the city of London is not easy.
But something exciting happened during that period too, didn't it?
Well, everything was exciting at St. Paul's. I mean, nothing was the same 2 days running. And put that together with the politics of the clergy there. St. Paul's is a very strange place. Somebody once called it God's railway station, which I think is a fairly apt. You've been in St. Paul's. I mean, it's never quiet.
No,
have you ever heard St. Paul's quiet?
No, never quiet.
I have, because I've been in late at night. Mm. On 3 a.m. with the night watchman practicing. And it is a very beautiful and holy space then. But in the middle of the week, it is it's a tourist trap. People are holding up umbrellas.
Well,
and
of course, that's how they keep the place open.
Every day was big. And there were lots of state occasions while
now,
I was there.
Now, what years are we talking about?
74 to 84.
Now, what happened in 81?
81 was the a certain wedding.
which you were participating in.
It was known as the wedding.
The wedding.
In uppercase, T-H-E.
Of the century.
It was going to be the big fairy tale, which didn't actually turn out to be the big fairy tale for various reasons. But I was sitting at lunch at home, and my colleague, the organist, was actually in Australia on a bit of sabbatical leave. They suddenly announced, Prince Charles has announced his engagement, and the wedding is to be in St. Paul's Cathedral. And I sort of swallowed hard. And it's going to be on July the 29th, they said, this year. And this was in February sometime. And from then on, of course, the phone rang. And every television station in the world wanted to come and film choir practice and wanted to come and film Evensong and everything else. So that was a frantic period. But we'd already done big ones before then. We'd done the Queen Mother's 80th birthday service a year before. And the monarch in England always goes to St. Paul's for Silver Jubilee, Golden Jubilee and Diamond Jubilee. And we'd done the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 77. So we were used to the big occasions. I mean, they were, you know.
This was not daunting to you at all. I mean, this is just run. It was one, another job, I guess.
It was another day in the life of. I mean, I can remember the choristers sort of having a quick chat beforehand saying, now let's see who we can spot in the congregation. I wonder if Mrs. Thatcher will be in the third row and all that sort of thing. And Mrs. Reagan was there, you know, and people like that, all the guests. But as far as I was concerned, it was another day. We worked quite hard on the music that was specially written for the occasion. And we had our hair done by somebody from Vidal Sassoon.
Oh, my.
So we couldn't lie down the night before in case we ruffled it up, you see.
What about makeup? Because it was televised.
No.
Nothing.
No makeup. No,
they didn't really concentrate on you.
No. It was a little bit of a circus, to be honest.
But very thrilling.
Very thrilling to be there. But it was another day in the life of St. Paul's. You know, see many, many big occasions. I think it had the biggest television audience in the whole wide world for a musical premiere. William Matthias, who wrote Let the People Praise Thee, O God, the late William Matthias, his anthem, I think was watched by 660 million
people. Oh, my goodness.
Now, can you tell me a composer who's ever had a bigger audience?
I'm going to read something now, and you have to clarify this.
Can I ask you where you got it from?
This was on the internet, actually, and this was a short bio of Barry Michael Rose, and it said that he left St. Paul's in 1984 after a difference of opinion with senior members of the clergy and became master of the choirs at the King's School, Canterbury.
Yes.
What does that mean exactly?
Earlier I mentioned stepping out of line slightly. Now, what I did was I took the boys into the world of Boys of St. Paul's Cathedral Choir, into the world of pop music. This is something they'd never done before, and I don't think any cathedral choir had done it before. I took my example from this group called the King Singers.
Yes, they're a wonderful group.
Who were choral scholars of King's College, Cambridge, who sang Gesualdo and Palestrina one minute, and the next minute sang arrangements of the Beatles and things like that. And I just thought to myself, well, there's room for the boys to do this. And one of your singers over here was called Harry Nilsson, the late Harry Nilsson. And he heard that we were available to do something, so we went and did a backing track with him in a studio in London. Now, I used to call these things for the boys educational outings, which they were, in fact, but they were glad to get out of the choir school on a Saturday night. You know, they've got kicking their heels there, just kicking a ball around the yard, and there's no point in just leaving them there when you could go and do something musical. And what is more, they would get a fee for it. You know, and it was a nice experience for them to meet these people. So we went off and did it. And this led to other things, and there was a television programme about the song My Way. The BBC ran a documentary about the song My Way that lasted for 40 minutes, and what they were going to do is going to get everybody's reaction to the song My Way and have clips of everybody who'd sung it. So they had Elvis on it, they had Frank Sinatra on it. And we were sandwiched between Frank Sinatra and Elvis because they wanted a boys' choir to sing this like a hymn.
Oh, okay.
So I took the boys round to a little city church and I played on a tiny little organ. And it was very cold. I remember they sang slightly sharp and slightly out of tune, but it didn't really matter. And they sang My Way and I did an interview about it. And the Daily Telegraph, again, the television critic, wrote this was a masterstroke on the part of the BBC. And the Dean and Chapter went ballistic. The Dean and Chapter are the canons who run the cathedral.
Well, another line in this bio says, his enforced resignation in 1984 caused a storm of publicity in the national press.
That is absolutely true. I think it's the only time that anyone's left an appointment and it's made headlines on the 9 o'clock news, the BBC 9 o'clock news. It was actually the first item that came up before any world thing.
Isn't
somewhere I've got a video of it.
Unbelievable.
With the boys in the background singing Bridge Over Troubled Water, which I thought was rather good. When we recorded that in the choir school.
But how did you, what did you do? How did you accept this? Or didn't you?
The time had come, I think, for me to say, look, I've done everything here. I could have stayed on St. Paul's. I had no need to resign. I didn't get on with the clergy. They didn't like the way I was taking the choir into this world of pop music. We recorded with Paul McCartney. Now, it's not every chorister who can say, I've been conducted by Sir Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney conducted them, and I conducted the orchestra. We thought we'd swap round.
Oh, why?
Sir Elton John, they, you know, all these people, they met. And it's,
well, an exciting experience for
them.
Yeah,
and who's to say that they're going to go into classical music? That's not necessarily true. They could go into any field of music or any other life. It's part of their education. And I didn't see eye to eye with the Dean Chapter about this at all. Neither did I see eye to eye with my colleague, who thought that this was not the way the choir should be going. But my line was, look, we sing Evensong perfectly. We put our heart and soul into Evensong. What we do in our spare time, really, is up to us.
So they felt it was too commercial and it was not really in the line of a church.
But I believe now they use the gold disc that we got from My Way.
I was going to say, not only that, but I mean, there's nothing to say. You were a renegade. You did what you had to do. You believed in it. Now other people are doing it, and you had the courage to continue on.
Isn't that funny enough? That's what the song My Way says. I did what I had
to
do.
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry about that.
But you did. Yes. You did. Yes. And actually, what drove you was who you are, what you believe in, and you just kept going.
Yes, that's right.
And of course, it got better and better.
I mean, it wasn't easy, and it was against all the odds. But, you know,
and a system that's very rigid.
And I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, I'm having done it that way.
Well, that's the only way to live. And what a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming.